Maybe true that teenagers are different. The teenagers really have uniquely teenage problems. Or is it true that you're a child for a while and then you're not? That's it. There's no in-between stage. For the teenager, the crisis or the problem is that they're going through a transition. The transition from no identity to some identity. Because until you're a teenager, there really is no me that is identifiable. Of course, a teenager says, I want my, the child, before he's a teenager, will say, give me my, this, that, and the other, but the me doesn't mean anything, and my doesn't mean anything. It's just childish. A well-adjusted child, a happy child, is busy being his mother's or his father's baby. That's his identity. That's her identity. Sometimes that's fun, sometimes it's painful, but that's who they are. They are their parents' child. When they get to adolescence, then suddenly they get these stirrings of an identity of their own. They're not sure what this is. They're not sure they want it, but it's there. It frightens them, it confuses them. And on the other hand, it thrills them. It's a challenge. And so they're in this transition period where they are no longer their mommy's child, but they're not any identifiable person either. So it's nishtahin nishtaher, which in English is called teenager. And the parents find themselves going through a transition, through a crisis as well. As long as your child was a child, his faults, his misbehavior, his lack of menschlichkeit was childish. And you're very comfortable, willing and able to grapple with the problem, to figure out what's bothering the child, and what can you do to help. When the teenager starts acting out, it begins to sound very much like you. Suddenly you see yourself reflected in your teenager. And that is hard to take. Because that's the one thing you dreaded the most. That's the one thing you prayed very hard should not happen. That your child, your son, should not have your chesedimus, should not have your problems, your faults. So the impatience or the intolerance that we have for our children's misbehavior is to a great degree an impatience with ourselves. We dread the thought that we passed on our ugliness to our children, and to see it reflected back from them is really very devastating. And that's very common. The older they get, the harder it is to take, because the older they get, the more they look like you, and the more they sound like you, and the more they behave like you, and your faults are being reflected back more clearly, more strongly, and more undeniably. So it might be helpful right from the start to make peace with the fact that if it's going to be your child, he's going to have your faults. And maybe that's what parenting is all about. Having a child means that you pass on to your child your chesedimus, your faults and your weaknesses, And then raising the child means teaching him how to handle the faults you know best, you're most familiar with. And you have 30 years or whatever to work on those problems, and whatever solutions you come up with, you can offer it to your children. But to expect them not to have your faults is unrealistic. Besides, it would be much worse if they had somebody else's faults. Better they should have yours. It's a little more embarrassing, but in the long run, more livable. The teenager is trying to become a somebody. He's afraid to be a somebody. And so, one moment, there will be delightful little children pleasing their parents and getting great pleasure from having pleased their parents. And the next moment, they're not interested in pleasing you. They don't care what you want. They've got a life of their own, an identity of their own. They want, they know, they have to, they need, they blah, blah, blah. And this goes back and forth. In extreme cases, within an hour, they'll shift back and forth, back from being a child to being a non-child, and it can drive parents crazy. Of course, if you're slim and very able, there's another disturbing element, and that is that until teenage years, the misbehavior was eating the wrong foods, saying the wrong things, not making the bracha, not finishing the davening, not beginning the davening. Once they become teenagers, it all becomes sexual. Suddenly they're growing up and there's problems. And this is, again, for an able person, very difficult to deal with. Particularly since in Ohr Torah they don't yet have sex education classes. They're not about to have them. So you can't rely on the yeshiva to take care of it. And if you begin to see a child acting out, it's disturbing. It's scary. Now, the child who is an outright rebel, the child who simply turns around and says, I don't want to have anything to do with you. I don't want to hear what you have to say. I don't want to be like you. I don't want to live like you want me to live. We are on different sides of the fence. We are on opposite ends of the spectrum. You go your way, I'll go my way. Leave me alone. That sounds like more than just a young bird trying its wings. It sounds like there's something permanent about it, that already you have a generation gap and you're just not living in the same world anymore. When that happens, you need to figure out what caused this estrangement. How could it be that a child How can it be that winning your approval isn't the most important thing in his life? It should be. By nature, it should be. Because, I think we talked about this last time, your father's approval determines what you are. Your father's disapproval determines what you are. If your father thinks you're a schlemazel, then you are. If your father thinks you're a mensch, then you are. That's whose opinion counts the most. And being a mensch is 99% subjective. It all depends on who thinks you're a mensch. If your father thinks you're a mensch, then you are. You are, or you will be. If your father thinks you're not a mensch, then you won't be. And you're not. So, to a healthy child, the only important thing in the life, in his life, her life, should be winning parents' approval. Is it possible that your approval is simply not forthcoming? Is it possible that your teenager decided that he's never gotten a compliment from you yet, and he's given up waiting for it, he's given up hoping for it, and he's decided that since this is not going to be my the source of my salvation, I'm never going to get approval from my Father, so I'll go my own way. Keep your approval. Could it be that you've given approval too quickly, promiscuously? The child realizes he doesn't have to do anything to get approval. He can get away with murder. But for some reason, what should be natural to the child, what should be natural to the teenager, is not there. It's not there. He should be looking for your approval. Now, this doesn't mean that he should pander or fawn on you, begging for approval, which is a different problem completely. The opposite problem. It's not that he should be desperate for your approval. It should just naturally be the thing that he thrives on. It could also be that you never made it clear what it takes for him to get your approval. What would make you happy? What would make you consider him a mensch? I think the healthiest children that I've seen were children whose parents made no secret of what they considered a mensch. And what they considered a mensch was not unrealistic or exaggerated or all-inclusive. You have to be perfect at everything in order to be a mensch. They had a very specific, very identifiable, very recognizable expectation. And the child felt that that was reasonable, and that he will live up to that, and he will be a mensch, and he loves his father, and he'll have no problems, and if his father's happy, he's happy, and they live happily ever after. It may be confusing that you've told the child that all you want is that he should be a good yeshiva bacher. All you want is that they should go to school and do well at school. All you want is that they should be Hasidisha boys or girls. Haven't you made it clear what you expect? Don't they now know exactly what it takes for them to win your approval? And very often it's not the case. That's too vague. Everybody wants that. Everybody's father says that. But what do you, as an individual, want of me, as an individual? If you can be very specific and honest and ask yourself, if I could only get one thing, if I could only have one thing in which my son or daughter will be good at, what is it going to be? For some people, no question, no problem. They want the kid to be a Talmud Chacham. Meaning, very specifically, that they should know the Gemara by heart. And they don't vacillate. This is what they want, day after day, month after month, year after year. Do you know the Gemara by heart? And when the kid comes home and knows the Gemara by heart, it's heaven. It's heaven. Nothing more. That's it. That's it, you've made my day. Kid knows where he stands. But if a kid comes home with a report card, and he knows the Gemara by heart, and the father says, and how are you doing in Chassidus? What do you want from the kid? Everything. He should be good at everything. I see you have a very good report card, but I notice that in Tanakh you're a little schwach. What do you want from this kid? It's not that you're expecting too much. You're not telling him what you expect. You're not zeroing in on any of them. Are you saying that you're not interested so much in how he does in the Gemara and in the Chumash and in the Chassidus? All you're interested in is in how he does in Tanakh. Say that? Fine. Then he knows where he stands. But that's not the case. just another example of looking at the negative side. No matter what he does, you point out what he didn't do, hasn't yet done. It's not just that it's critical. It's not just that it's negative. It's that it leaves him with no definition of what you want, because you haven't decided what you want. If you want him to be good at everything, then you don't know what you want. You haven't decided. I remember in yeshiva looking at some of the parents, my chaverim and their parents, thinking, that is a weird man. He drives his kid crazy to do one thing well. Why is he hung up on that? See, if the father was hung up on Chassidus, he wanted the kid to know the Rebbe's Sicha from last Shabbos, and that's all he worried about. I thought, you know, this guy should get a little more balanced. You have to learn Gemara too, you know. Why doesn't he encourage his son to learn a little Gemara? It's out of balance. And then if the father was interested only in Gemara and really wasn't, well, what kind of Lubavitcher is this? But in the end, those boys did very well. They didn't miss a beat, not once. They knew exactly where they stood every year going through their teenage upheavals. They knew exactly what was expected of them, and they stayed the course and they did well. It also offers a teenager an opportunity for a healthy rebellion. If he knows for sure that all his father wants is to learn Gemara, and he feels like rebelling, what is he going to do? He'll back to learn Chassidus. And that actually happened also. One of the boys in my class, for an entire summer, he made up his mind. He is not going to open a Gemara. And for the entire summer, only Likut HaSichas, that's all. Which is radical and wild and crazy and rebellious and spiteful. But this guy knows his sichas. And in Halavai, our children should have those rebellions. But there's cartoons in the newspaper, and his kid comes home and says, Dad, what do you want from me or something? What do you... And the father says, Son, every person has to seek his own bliss. And you got to go out and decide what is right for you and go for it with gusto. And the next frame, the kid is having a tantrum. He's screaming. He's saying, how can I rebel against that? Give me something I can rebel against. This non-statement drives kids crazy. Because on the one hand, they can't do it. Seek your bliss. What kind of double talk is that? And on the other hand, they can't not do it. They can't even rebel. No, I won't. You won't what? Teenagers in transition need very unambiguous messages. More than children, more than adults, that's when they need the most firm, the most specific, the most definite, the most concrete instructions. Try being reasonable with a teenager and you drive him up a wall. Because he can't reason with you. His issue, his problem, his crisis is not a reasonable one. And it is not a crisis of reason. So when you try to be reasonable with a teenager, you're making him crazy. Not that you shouldn't reason with him when he's asking for it, when he's asking for a conversation, but to take this very reasonable posture. Look, kid, I'm not going to give you a hard time. I'm a reasonable guy. They don't want that. Don't be a mensch. Help him be a mensch. And to help him be a mensch, you shouldn't be so sophisticated and so open-minded and so tolerant. Make it clear what you want. Make it so clear that even a teenager can't miss it. Can't misinterpret it. and don't budge until the crisis is over. Get fixed, drop your anchor, and stay put so that the kid can go through his fits and through his mood swings and mind swings and always find you where he left you. Don't shift on him. He's got enough shifting of his own going on. Don't change horses on him. He's lost enough as it is. And don't be open-minded to where yesterday you said he can't do it, but today you figure, all right, if you want, okay, he said the way. You're not going to win him over that way. You're not going to become his best friend that way. Stick by what you're all about so that he knows where home base is. So when he gets disoriented, he can always look and find you where he left you. That there is something stable in his life. Not everything shifts because he's going through a hormonal upheavals. So when a kid is having a fit, I don't know what to do. Why can't I do this? How can I go there? Why shouldn't I? You simply say, look, this is the way it is. It's always been this way. It'll always be this way. The world is not leaving. The world is not shifting. Only you're busy, nobody else. So wait until it passes, and you'll find that I'm still here, it's still here, it's still true, it's still this way, life goes on. And be firm about it. Be stable when his life is not. What about the questions? The questions. Why can't I do this? How come I'm not allowed? Why does this have to be this way? Why don't you do this way? Why don't you do that? Well, how come you don't have to? How come my friend doesn't have to? How come this? How come? All those painful questions that really can't be answered because the person asking the question can't sit still long enough to hear an answer. Good questions. But nobody home to answer. It's very frustrating. You think you're giving a pretty good answer, and the next day it's as if you never said anything. One of the things that helps is to reinforce the question. Don't even try to answer it, even if you have an answer. You gotta remember that going through those difficult years, there's nobody there up on top. He's out to lunch, and he's not listening, even to the answer to his own question. What might help is to reinforce the question. Assure him that the question is valid. Good question. And that the answer is not immediately available. Why is the answer not available? For a variety of reasons. Either when you get older, you'll understand. It's an age question. This kind of a question can be only answered at a certain age, and you're not of that age yet. So when you get older, then you'll understand. When you finish whatever you're doing and you graduate from this particular class, then I will answer you. You do what you have to do, I will come up with an answer. So you delay the answer. There will be an answer, but it's not available right now. Another form of this is, this is the kind of a question you have to ask a mashpia. What does your Rebbe say? Or ultimately, you have to write to the Rebbe. It's a good question. You have to ask the Rebbe. That does two things. First of all, you're affirming the question. You're treating him like a mensch. He asked a question and you took him seriously. And it's such a good question that not every father can answer it. You have to ask a mashpia. You have to ask a Rebbe or the Rebbe. Chances are that once you've said that, the question no longer needs an answer. He won't ask his mashpia. Doesn't care anymore. He got what he needed. You recognized him as a mensch. Secondly, if he does really want an answer, he'll be more likely to accept it after you've built it up that way and referred it on to a higher authority. At least when he'll ask his Rebbe or his Mashpia, he'll listen. When he's asking you, he may not even be listening, because to him the question is more important than any answer you'll give him. When you build up the question and he gets mileage out of that and really wants an answer, then he will listen when the answer comes. And the third possibility is to simply say, I don't know. In many cases, that's the truth. I don't know. It's a good question. I had that question. I asked that question. I don't know. But I do know what you need to do. You have to do such and such. I don't know what the answers to the questions are. You won't lose your son's respect by not knowing the answer. We're afraid that if we don't know an answer, they won't respect us anymore. It's not true. Your son doesn't need you to be a genius. He needs you to be a mensch. And it's very menschlich to not know an answer to a question. And to admit it. That puts him in your ballpark. You're in the same ballpark. And that's more comforting, more reassuring, and more valuable to the child than any answer you're going to give him. So in brief, as the teenager goes through his crisis, he needs to become closer to you. Whatever you can do to help that happen, you're helping your son through his difficult time. Answers to the questions may not do it. The fact that you take his question seriously, the fact that you don't know the answer any more than he does, the fact that you assure him that there will be an answer. The most valuable ingredient in all of that is that it brings you closer. You've got something you've shared. If you simply answer him, you haven't shared his question. On the contrary, you've rebuffed it. You made light of it. You had an answer ready and prepared and rehearsed. There's no connection there. There's no mutual involvement. He asked a question. You gave an answer. Adults, at least sometimes, adults appreciate that kind of interaction. A husband and a wife, a mashpia and a mekabela, give and a take, that's wonderful. But a teenager is not mature enough to appreciate that kind of exchange. If he has a problem, he appreciates someone who shares his problem. He doesn't appreciate someone who solves it. Because his problem is not the problem. His problem is he doesn't know who he is, where he's going, or what's happening. If you share that with him, you're reassuring him. If you answer his questions, he's back to where he started from. He doesn't know who he is, where he's going, what's happening. But now he knows the answer to the question. So, as Rabbi Shvei used to tell us in Montreal, when a person asks you a question, don't answer what he asked. Answer who he is. Answer the person, not the question. If a person says, you say that we should trust God, that everything will be fine when we're going through difficult times, but what if it's so such an emergency, and it's so dangerous, and it's so this and that, that you can't rest, and you can't find peace, and you can't do it? So we're going to quote something from... obviously, the question doesn't need to be answered. The person needs to be reassured. It's not a question, it's a problem. You don't answer a problem. A teenager is a problem, not a question. If you answer his questions, you frustrate him, because it keeps you distant from him. He's asking you a question and thereby reveals his neediness, and you throw him an answer. You're not taking care of his needs. Share the question. Agonize with him over the question. Tell him there will be an answer, but in the meantime, the question stands. Then you've shared something. You've gotten down and joined him where he is in his question. What about these issues? Shouldn't there be some class, some session, some instruction? It says in Bereishis, it says about the kings that Avraham fought with, the four that beat the five. So it says that Yud Beis Shana, Shtenesri Shana, Avdu'es Kidol La'omer. For 12 years, the four kings served Kidol La'omer. And when they became 13, and the 13th year, they rebelled. And Hasidus says that that's the story of our life. For 12 years, we serve Kidol La'omer. Kidol La'omer comes from the word La'omer, speech. For 12 years, we basically, our morality centers around our speech. Don't say dirty words, don't lie, don't be disrespectful, daven, make a bracha, bench, say meidani. For 12 years, that's the issue in a child's life. Comes 13, never do. All of a sudden, they rebel. And what is the rebellion? The rebellion is sexual. Suddenly, the issue in the child's life is not the mitzvahs you do in speech. All of a sudden, it's a more visceral issue. So, I mean, obviously, traditionally, the way it's always been, nothing is said. You let it go and hope for the best. And when that doesn't happen, we're really unequipped. What do we do? What do we say? What is the attitude? There is nothing as powerful and as useful and as helpful when it comes to sexual tensions. There is nothing as useful as humor. Laugh about it. Joke about it. Mock it. Because the biggest problem in the teenager's life is that his sexuality seems so important. It's so overwhelming. It's so heavy. It's so big. It's so devastating. It isn't. It's a silly Yetzirah, and you make jokes about it. Sad but true. That's how adults let off steam. How do adults handle their sexuality? They make jokes. They don't have to be vulgar jokes, but to the subject, pertaining to the subject. You laugh about it. There's a certain disarming naturalness that needs to be introduced to lessen the tension, to minimize the shock. And that comes through humor. I hate to give examples of dirty jokes, but something happens on the subway. Somebody fell and tore his pants and ripped them open, or a woman tripped him, and it was very embarrassing and very not sneeze and so on. It takes all the tension out of it. It was a joke! And you come home and you say, oh, the funniest thing happened. And it was not sneezed at, and it was so hilarious. First of all, it opens the door. Your kid is not terrified to bring up the subject anymore because you brought it up. You made a joke about sneeze and about men and women and boys and girls. So you let them know, in that subtle, indirect way, you let them know that issues about sneeze and boys and girls and subways, and it's talkable. It can be mentioned. Secondly, he sees that you won't get bent out of shape. You won't get all self-righteous about it or sanctimonious about it, and you won't lecture him. You have a sense of humor about the subject. And most important, even if he never says anything, he's gotten the message. Sex is something you don't necessarily have to be afraid of. You can laugh at it. And so now he's better able to dismiss his own sexuality with a little grain of salt. Here's a Rosh Hashiva. I don't know if he wants to be known for this, so I won't mention any names. But a great Rosh Hashiva, very great man. And when people would ask questions that were totally theoretical and off the subject, like a person would say, yeah, but what if the thing fell into the pot? And he was annoyed by these what ifs. And his answer would be, and it was known, his answer would be, what if my grandmother had different organic parts? She would be my grandfather. The first time we heard it, it was like, what's with this guy? What kind of talk is this? Shameless. But looking back at it, he was teaching a classroom full of teenage boys. It was wonderful. It was wonderful. It released all the tension. And you can imagine what was discussed after that class. Not the shir, not the gemara. It was like all of a sudden, oh, we can talk. We can talk. It's very useful. It's also useful if something is said or something is mentioned that is slightly off color. bathroom humor or something, your response should be to your teenage son, stop it, your mother's listening. It's like, you know, we can, you and I, we can do, but not in front of your mother. A little humor goes a long way. It wouldn't hurt on a proper occasion with the right setting and so on to sit your son down one day and say, no, so how's your Yetzer Hara? Don't pursue it. Don't demand an answer. But let him know you know. Let him know that it's the way it goes. Them's the Yetzer Hara's ways. And that you struggle, you fight, you... On top of it all, we are not policemen. Our role as parents is not to step in every time the kid misbehaves. We're not there to enforce the law. We're there to raise the child. The more you see a child getting into bad habits or thinking bad thoughts or getting kind of bogged down in this swamp of machshava zaros or whatever, the more you need to change the subject, introduce some interesting activities, get them busy, keep them busy, but don't focus on the negative. You're not going to stop it. You're not going to be there to prevent it every time it comes up. Give it, let it be. Let it be. The misbehavior is merely a reminder to the parents that this kid has too much free time. He's not excited enough about anything healthy and positive. So find something healthy and positive. I don't remember the story. The Rebbe was giving out tanyas on Yitzhak. And there were a couple of kids who got their tanya and sat down not far from the Rebbe on the steps. One of the kids had the tanya between his knees and he was bouncing the tanya up and down. Maybe playing with the tanya in a disrespectful way. The Rebbe looked at the kid a number of times trying to catch his eye, but the kid was busy. The Rebbe went back to giving out his tanyas, looked at the kid again, the kid was still doing it. And finally the Rebbe wouldn't let it go on anymore. The Rebbe turned to Groner. And he said, give him something to play with. Not what a typical person would do, what an average person would do. The average person would say, get that kid out of here. Get him on my nerves. The Rebbe's response, when he couldn't take it anymore, the Rebbe's response was, give him something to play with. A child needs something to play with. Not negative. Not take it away, throw him out, hit him, scream at him. Give him something to do. A child needs what to play with. Not negative. Not take it away, throw him out, hit him, scream at him. Give him something to do. A child needs what to play with. Only positive, even under the stress and the pressure and the urgency of the moment. Always positive. So what happened is Rabbi Groner panicked. What do you mean, give him something to play? Give him what? So in the confusion, he handed the kid a ring of keys. He said, give it to the Rebbe's ring. So as he's handing the keys to the Rebbe grabs the key. He says, not that. So gave him a couple of dollars. But in all of this, you know, still giving out the time he is now, didn't miss a beat. You can see it on the video. but the positiveness. Not take it away from the kid. Not stop that kid. It's give him something to play with. The teenager who has too much free time is bound to get into trouble. A teenager has to have an activity, a project, something that he does passionately. And that's where the passion needs to go, into the activity. Somebody once came to the Rebbe years and years and years ago, and he said he's very upset because his kid is a fanatical baseball fan. He said, the kid, er liegt in dem Togernacht. So the Rebbe said, I've seen him. I've checked him out. The Rebbe says, I'm durchgeguckt. I checked him out. He's a good kid. Baseball, I really need Sahaja. At least it was in those days. It was an innocent Yitzhahara. And for a teenager, that's okay. That's okay. So a teenager needs to have a Reino Yitzhahara, which means simply an innocent passion. A passion for something innocent. Because he needs an outlet for the passions. So if he's passionate about his learning, then you've got a little tzaddik on your hands. If he's passionate about some project at home that he likes to do, build, write, you know, draw, make, break, fine. Then that should be his outlet, and you have to approve of it and encourage it. And if there isn't anything, you've got to try your darndest to find something that will interest him, that will intrigue him, that will challenge him, and become an outlet for his passions. Some passionate pursuit, as long as it's innocent. In a healthy relationship, in a healthy family, a teenager looks to the parents for some kind of indication of what the parent thinks about his friends. And it's not like bringing a girl home and asking your father what he thinks of her. Any friend you bring home, you kind of check to see, what does your father think? And after all, these are my friends. This is a reflection on me. And you want some kind of a reaction, some kind of a confirmation from your father as to, do you approve of my friends? Generally in Crown Heights, you approve of the friends. There's no friend you disapprove of. This doesn't mean that you can't have an opinion. This doesn't mean that you shouldn't point out, oh, that friend, he seems to have a problem with his gaiva. This friend, he has some bad habits. Look at the way he doesn't take care of himself. He never ties his shoes. Or the other friend, I noticed the other day he was sitting with a very not respectful posture. Or is he just lounging on the bench in front of 770? He has to sit more respectfully. Without condemning the friendship, without discouraging the friendship, merely using the friendship as a reflection of pointing out virtues, faults, good things, bad things, taking some kind of, playing some kind of a role in the friendships, in those relationships, and also to compliment when a compliment is due. Come home and say, oh, I saw your friend in shul today. He was really, I liked the way he davens. He was davening really nice. Don't ignore his friends. They're a big part of his life. Don't condemn his friends. They're a big part of his life. But be involved. Have something to say. Participate. Or ask. Say, does your friend do such and such? not as a cross-examination or a third degree, but just because you're interested. If he's your kid's friend, then you're concerned, then you're interested in his friend. Any friend of yours is a friend of mine, kind of an attitude. But that doesn't mean that you can't criticize a friend. I think a chutzpah that a child who is also a healthy child, I'm not talking about a frustrated kid who's letting out his frustrations through chutzpah, or a kid with hypertension who lets it out through chutzpah, but a normal kid who's got the spirit and he's chutzpah with it, like most of the kids. That bravado should be channeled positively. You don't want to make him into an idiot kid. You want to make him into a productive kid. And with all that energy, he could be very productive. So you don't want to go to the opposite extreme. That's unreasonable. You don't want him to become meek and respectful. You want him to use his energies productively. And in 100 different ways, you got to say that to him. But if you threw that energy into whatever, you're very successful. Or you're going to be successful, I can see it. You're not afraid of anybody, you say what you want, this is wonderful. But you have to talk like a jerk. So appreciate the etzem characteristic, the energy behind it, and then very slightly change the direction. But don't put down the energy. Don't put down the positive side of a child who isn't afraid to say what he thinks and is not intimidated by authority. A couple of years ago, if you were that way, you were a hero. Mother should do it. Part of the question to you, nobody will ask you. But if you say, we can negotiate most things, but you shall I when we can't negotiate. Who asked you? What did you say that for? Why did you even introduce the possibility that it could be negotiated? Father says to his teenage son, he says, you want to go on a vacation? Fine, okay. You want to do the traveling? I say, okay. But don't get any girls pregnant. What is that? Where is that coming from? Obviously, you're not sure that it's out of the question. So, if you're not sure, why should you be sure? It's literally true in 99% of the cases. That which to you is unthinkable to your son. Without you having to say anything. So if it's not out of the question to your son, it's because it's not out of the question to you. So why do you expect it to be out of the question to him?